pack leaders correct pack followers. Natural dog packs are filled with rules, boundaries, and limitations. There are dozens of unspoken rules of etiquette in a wild dog or wolf pack, sometimes communicated by energy, sometimes by body language, sometimes by a physical touch or a bite. A correction, what some people might call a punishment, is simply a consequence of a dog's breaking the rules. With dogs, there's always a consequence to breaking rules, no exceptions. If the pack members could talk, they'd say to an offender, "You're not being disciplined like us. You're not part of our pack. We're going to give you one chance. You do it again, and you're out of here. Either we'll kill you, or we'll kick you out of the pack." Dogs don't resent other dogs for correcting them. And dogs don't hold grudges against dogs that make mistakes. They correct and then move right on with their lives. It's all very simple and natural to them. In nature, setting limits isn't cruel, and in order to set limits, all animals sometimes need corrections. We all know human parents who don't set limits. It's their kids who are running around the restaurant screaming and throwing food and disturbing your nice quiet dinner. They're the parents calling for Nanny 911 when their house is in chaos. Think about how humans learn. We often need to make mistakes and be corrected before we know what the rules are. If you're in an unfamiliar state where you don't know the traffic laws and you make a right turn on red, a policeman stops you and tells you there's no right turn on red in that state. Now you know the rules, but he's going to give you a ticket anyway. That's your punishment. That's your correction, and it will probably work. After paying a $250 ticket, you can bet you'll never make a right on red in that state again. Like humans and all other animals, dogs need to be corrected when they break a rule. The reason I like the word correction rather than punishment is that the latter word has human connotations, and too many people correct their dogs the way they would punish a child. With a child, they'll take away a privilege. You didn't clean up your room, so you can't go to the ball game tomorrow. Or, after yelling at the child, send the child to his room. Dogs don't have a clue what you're saying when you're yelling at them. All they hear is your excited, unbalanced energy, which will either scare or confuse them, or which they'll simply ignore. Dogs don't have a concept of tomorrow, so you can't threaten them by withholding a trip to the dog park. If you send them to another room or put them outside, they probably won't make the connection between the banishment and the bad behavior. Dogs live in a world of cause and effect. They don't think, they react. So they need to be corrected the instant the unwanted behavior occurs. You can't even wait 5 minutes before correcting a dog, because chances are she's already moved on to another state of mind. Remember, dogs live in the now. Corrections have to happen in the now and be repeated every time the rule is broken before a dog will understand what aspects of her behavior are unwanted by you. How we go about correcting our dogs is also the subject of much debate. There is an influential school of thought right now that argues that positive reinforcement and positive training technique alone should be used with dogs or with any animal. In my opinion, positive reinforcement is to be desired and is wonderful when it works. It works for happy-go-lucky dogs and for the dogs we raise as puppies. If you can get the behavior you desire out of feeding your dog treats, by all means, go for it. But the dogs that come to me are often ones whose behavior is way out of control. They're rescued dogs who've had terrible pasts filled with abuse, deprivation, and cruelty. Or they're dogs who've lived their whole lives without any rules, boundaries, or limitations whatsoever. Then there are the red zone dogs that we've discussed. These dogs are too far gone to be rehabilitated simply by using treats. Abuse, on the other hand, is never acceptable. Hitting a dog isn't acceptable. You cannot use fear as a means of making an animal behave. It doesn't work. Showing an animal strong leadership and giving it rules is not the same thing as instilling fear and punishing it. The distinction is in how and when you use corrections. You never ever correct an animal out of anger or frustration. This is when animal abuse, or child abuse, or spousal abuse occurs. When you try to correct your dog out of anger, you are usually more out of control than your dog is. You are fulfilling your own needs, not the animal's, who will sense your unstable energy and often escalate the unwanted behavior. You can never let an animal push your buttons. You are there to teach her and show leadership, and if you're going to correct her, you must always remain in your calm, assertive state of mind. This may be a challenge for you, as it was for Jordan the Bulldog's owner, David. But perhaps that is why this animal came into your life, so that both of you could learn a healthier way of behaving. That said, when you correct your dog, it's your energy, mindset, and the timing of the correction that matter more than the method, as long as the method isn't abusive. Never strike a dog. A quick, assertive touch can snap a dog out of an unwanted state. I curl my hand into a claw shape so that when I quickly touch a dog's neck or just under its chin, my curled fingers feel like the teeth of another dog or of the dog's mother. Dogs often correct one another with gentle nips, and touch is one of the most common ways with which they communicate. A touch is more effective than a strike could ever be. Use the least forceful technique possible to snap a dog out of an unwanted behavior or state of mind. Your purpose is to redirect the dog's attention back on you as the pack leader. Correction can be anything from a sound, a word, a snap of the fingers, whatever works best for you and doesn't do physical or mental harm to the dog. What works for me in correcting dogs is to practice what they do with one another. Eye contact, energy, body language, and forward motion toward each other. Remember, dogs are always reading your energy, and they'll know what you mean when your energy tells them it's not okay to do that. When I have a dog on a leash, I'll give a little tug upward to snap the dog out of unwanted behavior. It's a short little jerk that barely lasts a moment and doesn't hurt the dog. But the timing of it is vital. Whatever the correction method, it has to happen the split second the dog begins the unwanted behavior. This is where knowing your dog comes in. You need to learn to read your dog's body language and energy almost as well as she's already reading yours. For example, all dogs love to roll in the carcasses of dead animals. It's how they disguise their scent in the wild when they hunt, and it's one of Mother Nature's most ingenious inventions, a behavior that's embedded deep in the dog's genes. However, when dogs live with us, having them come home covered with dead skunk or squirrel isn't only unpleasant, it's also unsanitary. I like dogs to live as naturally as possible, but as pack leader and the one who's paying the bills, I think it's within my right to try to limit this aspect of my dog's behavior. So if I see a dog begin to sniff something unusual, I've got to correct her instantly before she begins to run toward the scent. Remember, dogs are much faster than we are. If you miss reading her mind, and therefore miss the opportunity to give correction, you're going to be washing dead skunk out of her fur when you get home. The dominance ritual. Another controversial aspect of correction is the dominance ritual, what most trainers and behaviorists call the alpha role. It's a replica of what dogs or wolves do with each other in the wild. The dominant dog puts another dog on his side until that dog signals submission. It's basically a wolf asking another wolf to cry uncle and admit that he's been one-upped. This is the way a pack leader keeps order without having to resort to all-out violence against other pack members. To hear some behaviorists talk, putting a dog into an alpha role is as cruel as lighting him on fire. I have been criticized by many in the positive-only school of behavior and called inhumane and barbaric for using this technique. I respect those critics' opinions and agree that this technique is appropriate only for certain cases and to be used by experienced dog handlers. If you feel, as they do, that this method is cruel, then you should regard my advice with that in mind. I believe that when it comes to how we relate to animals, it is always a matter of personal conscience. In my opinion, asking a dog to submit to me by lying on her side is a very natural thing to do. Within my own pack, a stern look, a sound, or a gesture from me will almost always send an errant dog into a submissive state, sitting or lying, without my ever having to touch her, or in some cases, even come near her. It goes without saying that I'd always rather get the behavior I want with simply a look or a sound than with a touch. However, with extremely dominant dogs, with dogs that attack people or other dogs, or with two dogs that are fighting with each other, I sometimes have to physically put the dog or dogs on their side. A dominant dog will put up a fight, wouldn't you, if you were used to being boss? And will struggle against me. This is natural. If you've gotten away with a certain kind of behavior all your life, you're going to rebel against someone who finally tells you no. In this case, I have to hold on firmly until that dog stops resisting. I started using this technique with my first pack of Rottweilers and still use it whenever necessary. It elicits a primal response in the dog that I am the pack leader. When outsiders see a dog lying on her side, ears back, eyes forward, they assume the dog is responding to me that way out of fear. This isn't a fearful position. It is a totally submissive position, as submissive as you can get. In the dog world, this is the ultimate sign of respect, of surrender. Submission and surrender don't have negative connotations in the dog world. There's no such thing as humiliation because a dog doesn't dwell on the past. A dog isn't going to hold it against me. Although many of the dogs in my pack at some time in their lives have had to submit after misbehaving, they still love me and follow me every day. With 40 dogs in one place, not a day goes by without someone getting into mischief. But mischief can escalate into more disruptive and dangerous behavior, and like any good pack leader, it's my job to stop it before it goes that far. When it comes to the dominance ritual, however, please take note. Although I personally practice it in my work rehabilitating severely unbalanced and aggressive dogs, I caution anyone who isn't a professional, or at least extremely experienced in dog behavior and aggression, never, ever to forcibly put a dog on its side. With a dominant or aggressive dog, someone who is inexperienced could easily be bitten, mauled, or attacked. This is serious stuff, life-threatening stuff. If your dog is exhibiting the kind of behavior problems that require this kind of correction, then you should be consulting a professional anyway. You should not be on your own in attempting to restore discipline to a dog that's this far gone in terms of dominance or aggression. Rules, boundaries, and limitations. You have house rules for your children. Why shouldn't you have the same for your dog? So many of my clients come to me after they've hit rock bottom. Their dog is literally running the household, and the family is thrown into chaos. Many of my clients admit to me in shame that they're isolating themselves. They don't see their friends anymore because they fear what their dog might do when a new person comes to the house. Their lives have become unmanageable, almost as if they were living with an alcoholic or a drug addict in the family. some beautiful people I was fortunate to meet during the first season of my television series, The Francescos, had been a boisterous, outgoing, very social Italian-American family, until a tiny Bichon Frise named Bella came into their lives. By the time I met them, they had stopped inviting the rest of the family over to their house for fear that Bella might attack them. This tiny ball of fluff didn't even weigh 10 pounds, but she controlled the entire family. She would bark nonstop at anyone who entered the house, and never stop barking until that person left. The Francescos loved Bella. It had been the dying wish of a beloved aunt that the Francescos have a puppy for her orphaned daughter and niece to love. Bella represented something spiritual to them, a person they loved very much but had lost. So they tiptoed around her, never giving her any rules, boundaries, or limitations. They didn't realize that they weren't doing Bella any favors by pampering her. She was a very unbalanced dog, always on edge because she was trying so hard to be a pack leader and not doing a very good job of it. She wasn't having a good time in life. Most dogs instinctively know that they're not meant to run your household. They don't want to run your household. But if you're not doing it, they sense they have no choice but to try to take over. It's instinctual for a dog to crave rules and structure in her life. Nature is all about rules and rituals of behavior. Now that domestic dogs live with us, it's up to us to set the rules. What you allow and you don't allow in your own household is up to you. Whether the dog sleeps on your bed with you, whether she's allowed on your furniture, whether she can dig in the backyard, whether she's permitted to beg for food at the dinner table. But there are certain behaviors of hers that I recommend you always block, because by allowing them, you could be encouraging dominance. You should not allow the dog to jump on you, or anyone else for that matter, when you walk in the door. You should not allow your dog to whine when separated from you. No possessiveness over toys. No snapping or biting. No jumping on you in bed to wake you up. No aggressiveness toward people or other dogs or household animals. No incessant barking. Some of the behaviors that you'll want to block may be instinctual ones. This is why you must be much more than just your dog's owner. You must be the pack leader. A pack leader controls both a dog's instincts and her genetics. As a dog owner, you can control only affection and genetics. A dog trainer can control only genetics. A dog handler can control only genetics. You can send your dog to obedience school and teach her how to sit, stay, come, and heal. You can teach her how to catch a frisbee or run an obstacle course. That's genetics. But just because a person goes to Harvard doesn't mean he's balanced when he graduates. And just because a dog knows how to obey doesn't mean she's balanced either. When you train a dog, you don't get access to that dog's mind. You get access only to conditioning. And conditioning doesn't mean anything in the dog world. Dogs don't care about winning the Westminster. They don't care about winning the prize for catching the most frisbees. A dog may be able to follow commands, or retrieve, or track, or do any number of things that her breed, her genetics, programs her to do. But can she play happily with other dogs without a fight? Can she travel in a pack? Can she eat her dinner without being protective over her food? That's instinct. A pack leader controls both. For example, you may have had this experience with your dog. She loves to play ball. In your backyard, you play catch and retrieve all day long. That's your dog's genetics. That's the breed in her. You control your dog's behavior, but with the ball. Her motivation to be with you is the ball, because you have the ball. But let's say your dog loses interest in the ball. Her new motivation is the cat. She starts chasing the cat. That's her instinct calling her. Can you control her now? Can you block that behavior? Or, without the ball, outside of the backyard, can you control your dog during a walk? Can you keep her from chasing squirrels while you're walking? You can't block her from chasing the cat or the squirrel with a tennis ball. The only way you can block these behaviors is with leadership. Unless you are in control of her instinctual side, you cannot predict or control what your dog may or may not do. As pack leader to 30 or 40 dogs at the Dog Psychology Center, I often have to block instinctual behaviors in order to keep the pack running smoothly. It's instinctual for dogs to mount one another. But sometimes I have to block them because if that behavior gets too intense, it could escalate into a fight. I don't allow the dogs to fight over food or over a tennis ball. No fighting or aggression is allowed in my pack. None is tolerated. No bigger dogs are allowed to go after smaller dogs. That's how our teacup chihuahua, Coco, can live happily in the same pack with two giant German shepherds, seven pit bulls, and a Doberman. I have to block the stronger dogs from going after the weaker ones or the ones who have unstable energy. It's natural for dogs to try to get rid of unstable energy in a pack member, but I have to teach my pack to accept weaker members and not harass them. That's how the pack helps rehabilitate unstable dogs, showing them, by example, what balanced, calm, submissive energy looks and feels like. I also block the dogs from chewing on or digging in the greenery or rolling in each other's poop. Those rules are my choices because they suit me as a human being. As pack leaders to our dogs, we have the right and responsibility to choose the rules they live by. However, whenever I block any instinctual behavior, I must replace it with another activity to redirect the energy. You can't just take something away and give nothing in return. The energy that drove the dog to the undesirable behavior doesn't just vanish because you blocked it. You must replace an undesirable activity with a desirable one. That's why I have obstacle courses, swimming pools, treadmills, tennis balls, and other distractions for the dogs at the center. That's why they spend from 5 to 8 hours every day in vigorous exercise, and why I make every activity, from walking to taking a bath to eating, a psychological challenge for them. If you don't give your dog ways to drain her energy and exercise her mind, it will be a lot more difficult for her to stick to the rules and boundaries that you set for her. If you are a good, responsible pack leader, you will provide not only the structure for her life, but plenty of outlets for her natural energy as well. 3. Affection. Dogs in the United States may be lacking in the amount of exercise and discipline they get every day, but they certainly aren't lacking in affection. That is why many people here choose to bring dogs into their lives, for that amazing, unconditional canine love and affection they share. And dogs are affectionate animals. They are very physical animals, and touch means a lot to them, both in their natural world and when they come to live with us. But as I've said before, affection that hasn't been earned can be detrimental to a dog, especially affection that is shared at the wrong time. When is the right time to share affection? After a dog has exercised and eaten. After a dog has changed his unwanted behavior into a behavior that you asked for. After a dog has responded to a rule or a command. If your dog jumps up on you demanding to be petted, it's probably your instinct to oblige her. This behavior sends her the signal that she is in charge. Share your affection only with a mind that is calm and submissive. Ask your dog to sit down and calm down. Then you share affection on your terms. Your dog will quickly come to realize that there is only one correct behavior to get her the things she wants. When is the wrong time to give affection? When your dog is fearful, anxious, possessive, dominant, aggressive, whining, begging, barking, or breaking any rule in your household. The owners of Bane and Hera, the killer dogs in San Francisco, were always giving affection to the dogs after the dogs had been terrorizing people all day. Anytime you give affection, you reinforce the behavior that preceded it. You cannot love a dog out of her bad behavior, just as you can't love a criminal into stopping his crimes. When I was first married to my wife, Illusion, she gave me all the love in the world. But it wasn't that love that snapped me out of the bad behavior that I was used to getting away with. What got me to change and become a good husband and partner was when she finally drew a line in the sand. I could shape up, or she was shipping out. I have to admit, it wasn't love that changed me. It was rules, boundaries, and limitations. You can find excellent examples of the proper way to give affection when you observe dogs that have jobs. Handicapped people with service dogs must understand that the dog isn't there just to be their friend. They have to learn to play the leadership role before they can expect the dog to turn on the lights, open the doors, or lead them to the bus stop. Even though these dogs have been trained by professionals, they won't respond to the handicapped person until that person learns to share calm, assertive energy. If you've seen these dogs in action, you've noticed they wear a sign that says not to give them affection while they're at work. By law, you can't touch those dogs. Affection will only create excitement, and a dog can't do her job when she's excited. When does the handicapped person share affection? After the dog has performed a task, and at home, at the end of a hard-working day. Dogs in search and rescue, and police dogs, don't receive affection while they're working, unless it's immediately after they have completed an important task. Drug enforcement officers don't play with their dogs all day and then expect them to calmly search out packages for illegal substances. To have to work for affection is a very natural thing for a dog. It's only we humans who believe that if we're not giving affection to the dog 24/7, we're somehow depriving it of something. Fulfillment. When I talk about fulfilling our dogs, I mean fulfillment in the same way we think about fulfillment in our own lives. Are we happy? Are we living each day to the fullest? Are we reaching our potential, exercising all the talents and abilities we were born with? It's the same thing for dogs. A dog's life is fulfilled if it can live comfortably in a pack, feeling safe and secure under the guidance of its pack leader. A dog is fulfilled if it has frequent primal exercise and, in some way, feels that it is working for food and water. A dog is fulfilled when it trusts its pack leader to set consistent rules and boundaries for it to live by. Dogs love routine, ritual, and consistency. They also love new experiences and the chance to explore, especially when they feel they have a reliable bond with their pack leaders. Dogs fulfill us in so many ways. They fill in for human companions when we're lonely. They keep us company on our morning walks. They give us something living, soft and warm to cuddle with. They serve as alarm clocks, burglar alarms, and sentries. They win us money in competitions. We don't ask them to do these things, but they do. They can't speak and ask us for what they need. Giving them these simple things, exercise, discipline, and affection, in that order, will go a long way toward thanking our dogs for everything they bring to our lives. Chapter 8. Can't we all just get along? Simple tips for living happily with your dog. Human beings and dogs have coexisted interdependently for thousands of years. In developing countries and in primitive societies, dogs are not always treated with the degree of love and kindness we give them in the United States. However, Dogs in those places don't seem to have all the issues and neuroses that they have here, either. How can we share our love with our dogs without giving them issues? How can we be strong pack leaders without losing the compassion and humanity that made us want to bond with dogs in the first place? These are questions that have no simple answers. However, I offer you some practical tips from my experience with clients that I hope will help you and your dog live a stress-free life and thus move you toward the highest levels of connection between two species. Choosing a dog. As I've mentioned before, choosing the right dog is the cornerstone of a long, fulfilling relationship between the two of you. Before you even commit to having a dog, however, please ask yourself what your motivation is for bringing that dog into your life. You don't need to share these musings with anybody else, but you need to be absolutely honest with yourself, because I promise you, you won't be able to fool a dog. Are you miserable and lonely and intending to use the dog as a surrogate for human companionship? Do you want the dog to play the role of the child you never had, or become a substitute for the kids who have just left your empty nest? Are you bringing the dog into a household to fill the emptiness in your heart after another dog has passed away? Do you want to have a tough-looking dog by your side for status, or a cute dog you can walk in the park to attract girls? Do you want the dog to be a protector and weapon and little else? If these are your primary reasons for wanting a dog, I ask you to remember that a dog is a living being with powerful feelings and needs and desires that are different from, but not lesser than, your own. A dog is not a doll, a child, a purse, a status symbol, or a weapon. In choosing a dog to share your life, you have an incredible opportunity to form a powerful bond with a member of another species. But that opportunity comes at a price, the price of responsibility. Know yourself before you know your dog. Before you take the plunge in becoming a dog owner, I recommend that you be able to answer yes to the first part of each of these important questions and no to the second part. Number one, am I committed to walking my dog for at least 1.5 hours every day? Or will I simply let the dog out in the backyard and rationalize that he is getting plenty of outdoor exercise? Number two, am I committed to learning how to become a calm, assertive pack leader with my dog? Or will I let my dog walk all over me because it's easier? Number three, am I committed to setting clear rules, boundaries, and limitations in my household? Or will I let my dog do anything he wants, whenever he wants? Number four, am I committed to providing regular food and water for my dog? Or will I feed him only when I remember to? Number five, am I committed to giving affection only at appropriate times and when my dog is calm, submissive? Or will I hug and kiss the dog when he's fearful or aggressive or whenever the mood strikes me? Number six, will I commit to taking my dog to the veterinarian on a regular basis, making sure he is spayed and neutered and has all his proper checkups and shots? Or will I only go to the vet when my dog is sick or injured? Number seven, will I make sure my dog is socialized and or trained properly so he is never a danger to other animals or people? Or will I hope for the best and warn people to stay out of my dog's way? Number eight, am I willing to clean up after my dog whenever I walk him? Or will I consider my dog's poop to be someone else's problem? Number nine, am I willing to educate myself on dog psychology in general and any specific needs my dog's breed has in particular? Or will I just lead by instinct? Number 10, am I willing to put some money away in case I have to call in a professional for a behavior problem or rush to the vet for a medical emergency? Or will the dog only get what I can afford at the moment? Did you pass? If you did, congratulations. You're ready for a dog. If not, you might want to rethink your choice of pet. There are plenty of homeless cats out there who need rescuing too, and their needs are very different and not as burdensome as a dog's. Now, which dog to choose? As I've said before, breed is one important factor, and there are many excellent guides you can pick up that will educate you about the hundreds of dog breeds out there. I recommend the American Kennel Club's Guide to Dog Breeds, with its beautiful color pictures and fascinating genetic histories of the purebred breeds. Bash Debra's Your Dream Dog is another book packed with information about choosing a breed that works for you. Mutts, America's Dogs, by Michael Capuzzo and Brian Kilcommons, takes a unique look at classifying mixed breeds. The story of dogs is a fascinating one, and you can never do too much reading about it. Still, when it comes to matching a human with his or her perfect dog, I believe that compatible energy is much more important than breed. Throughout this book, you've seen examples of dogs whose energy outmatched that of their owners. Jordan, the bulldog, is the first to come to mind. Emily, the pit bull, was another example. If you are a laid-back, mellow kind of person, a high-energy Chinese crested that jumps around in the kennel will only cause heartache or headaches for both you and the dog. If you're a runner who wants to jog with your dog, a lethargic, short-legged bulldog will not be your ideal choice. First, be honest about your own energy level. Then assess the energy of the particular dog you are thinking about getting. And take your time doing this. If you have the opportunity, return to see the dog on a second day, at a different time of day, to determine if there is any variation in behavior. Many people nowadays don't select purebreds from breeders, but instead go to the local shelter or rescue organization to adopt a dog that's been lost or abandoned. Since most of the dogs at my dog psychology center have rescues in their backgrounds, I applaud the altruism of those gestures. But too often, a person will fall in love with a cute dog at the pound, or a dog they feel so sorry for, and decide on the spot to adopt it. They will bring it home without thinking and end up in the kind of hell so many of my clients experience. This is unfair to the dog, because very often it gets returned to the shelter. And dogs that have histories of multiple returns run a higher risk of being euthanized. They also often develop new and often more serious issues, courtesy of every human who adopts and then rejects them. So, taking your time in choosing a dog is serious business. If you can afford to, bring a professional along with you when you make your final decision. You can also bring this person along to help you introduce the dog to your home. Bringing a dog home. When you bring a dog from a breeder or a shelter into your new home, remember that to that dog, you are simply transporting him from one kennel to another. You may have a $6 million, 50-acre, 14-bathroom kennel with a pool, hot tub, guest house, and tennis court. But to the dog, it's just a bigger kennel. Walls are not natural to animals, period, no matter which famous architect designed them. Therefore, you need to create the experience of migration for your dog before you bring him home. The very first thing you do once you reach your home is go for a long, long walk with your dog, at least an hour walk, through his new neighborhood. Take as long a walk as you can possibly afford, then add in an extra 20 minutes on top of that. During this walk, you are both building a bond of trust with your new companion and establishing your position as pack leader. The rules of your entire relationship are being established in those first important moments. Your dog is also getting the feeling of his new neighborhood. You are creating for him what it might feel like to migrate to a new home with his pack leader. And of course, you are tiring him out so he'll be more amenable to conditioning once you enter the house. Entering the house for the first time is as important as that first walk together. You have only one chance to make this first impression. If you do it right, you will save yourself a lot of heartache. If you do it wrong, you're going to have to rehabilitate your dog from day one. Make sure you enter the house first, then invite the dog in. Don't let your husband and kids come running out to shower the dog with affection and welcome him home. As hard as it will be for them, tell them to stand where they are. Bring the dog to them and let him approach them and learn their scents. By now, of course, you've taught everybody how to project calm, assertive energy. So that's all the dog will be feeling in the room, right? Most people give in to the temptation to let the dog roam the house and property, delighting at watching him sniff and suss out every new room and object. If you do this, especially if you are trailing around after him, you are allowing him to claim the entire property for his own. For the first 2 weeks, you must give him permission to do everything. The first night, dedicate a room for him and a sleeping place, possibly his crate or kennel. I often recommend that families hold off on affection for a week or two, until the dog has learned the rules of the house and become accustomed to his new pack. For most people, this is an impossible request, which I totally understand. Once your dog is quiet, in his kennel, and ready for sleep, then you can share affection and begin your heart-to-heart bonding. But remember, it's not loving energy, but the energy of your leadership that will make your dog feel safe and secure in your home. The next day, begin what will become your dog's regular routine. A long walk first thing in the morning, then food, then affection, then rest. Introduce the dog gradually to one room at a time, always making it clear that you are the one giving him permission to enter. Establish early on what is off-limits and what is okay. Don't waffle or change the rules, no matter how sad his brown eyes look. Remind yourself that your consistency and strength during this early phase are gifts you are giving the dog, every bit as important gifts as the food and shelter you share with him. You are giving him the gift of a solid, reliable pack, one in which he will soon be able to relax and become his calm, submissive self. The rules of the house. The rules you make for the dogs in your household are completely up to you. But there are some overall rules that I strongly recommend you follow in order to keep your pack leader status intact. Wake up on your terms, not his. Your dog is not your alarm clock. If your dog sleeps in your bed, condition him to get quietly off the bed if he wakes before you do and needs water or to stretch his legs. Then he needs to wait calmly for you to get up and start the structure of his day. Start the day with very little touch or talk, saving affection for after the walk. The walk is your bonding time together. If you walk, then try to walk for an hour every morning. If you are a runner, you run. If you're a biker or rollerblader, you bike or blade. Ideally, you have chosen a dog that is fit enough for whatever your preferred activity may be. And if it's a very active sport, you can shorten its duration. But walking at a brisk pace is the best overall exercise for both human and dog, both on a physical and on a psychological primal level. If you absolutely positively don't have a full hour to walk, add a backpack to make it a better workout for your dog, or put the dog on a treadmill for a half hour while you're getting ready for work. Feed your dog calmly and quietly, never giving him food when he is jumping up and down. He gets fed only when he's sitting down, calm, submissive. He never gets fed as a response to a bark. At the Dog Psychology Center, the calmest, mellowest dog always gets to eat first. Can you imagine what an incentive this is for the rest of the pack to act calm and submissive? Your dog doesn't beg for scraps or interrupt your mealtime. When the pack leader is eating, no one interrupts him. You set the distance your dog is allowed to be from the human dining table, and you stick to it. Don't buy your dog's pleading looks. His wolf forefathers never competed with their pack leaders for food, and neither should he. After exercise and food comes affection time. Instruct your dog to be in a calm, submissive position, and then love him till it's time to go to work. By doing this, you are conditioning your dog to have a beautiful, balanced, satisfying morning every day of the week. Never make a big deal about leaving the house, or coming home, for that matter. If you must leave a dog at home all day, practice going in and out of the house many times before the first few times you actually leave him alone. Make sure he's in a calm, submissive state whenever you leave or enter the house. Once he's in the position you desire, don't talk, touch, or make eye contact while you're leaving. As difficult as it may be for you, act cool toward your dog while projecting your calm, assertive energy. If you've properly exercised your dog and not nurtured his fear or anxiety, his natural body clock will tell him this is time for him to rest and to be quiet for a while. Do not allow howling or whining when you leave. You may have to wait several minutes before your dog is calm enough for you to leave, but be patient and make sure this routine sinks in for him. Don't worry. You'll be able to love him again when you come home. Once you return home, hold back as much affection as you can at first. Do not encourage overexcitement. Change your clothes, grab a snack to tide you over, and take your dog out again. This walk can be a bit shorter, a half hour, since you're going to be in for the evening together. After the walk, once again reinforce your mealtime rules, and then allow your calm, submissive dog to be your best friend after dinner. Sleeping arrangements for a dog should be clear and unambiguous. A dog should have a regular place to sleep and should not be able to choose it on his own. When your dog first comes to live with you, put him in his crate or kennel every night for the first week. This will get him accustomed to the new surroundings while providing limits. After the first week, replace the kennel with a pillow or dog bed. That is now his resting place. If you're a person who wants your dog to sleep in bed with you, fine. It's natural for dogs to sleep with other members of the pack, and it's a powerful way to bond with your animal. But don't let the dog take over the bed. Keep the rules clear. You invite the dog into the bedroom. Get in the bed for a few minutes, and then signal that your dog can come up. You choose the portion of the bed that the dog sleeps on. Sweet dreams. Every human in the household needs to be a pack leader. From your toddler to your elderly grandparents, your dog needs to respect everyone in the household as higher up on the dominance ladder than he is. This means that every human in the house has to live by the same set of rules, boundaries, and limitations. Discuss these together and make sure everybody considers them law. Remember, intermittent reinforcement creates an unpredictable dog that's much harder to condition in the long run. So, your 10-year-old can't sneak Max treats under the table if the family rule is no begging. You can't allow your dog to jump on the furniture when you're at home, but not when your husband is in the house. Inconsistent leadership leads to an inconsistently obedient dog. Scheduling playtime with your dog every week is a great way to add extra physical exercise to your walk routine, although by now you know it is never a substitute for the walk. It is also a way to let your dog express the special needs and abilities of his breed. You can play fetch, swim in the pool, play with the frisbee, and run an obstacle course. Whatever your pleasure or your dog's special talent, just make sure your dog has had at least one of his major walks before you play. Don't do it first thing in the morning. And set strict limits on the time you spend. Don't let your dog talk you into spending 3 hours throwing a tennis ball when you have set aside only one. Don't avoid or postpone bathing your dog just because he hates it. Though your dog probably doesn't care how clean he is, you deserve to have a dog you like to be near. There are many ways you can make bath time a more pleasant experience for both of you. First, let your dog get to know the tub or sink in a relaxed, pleasant way before you try to bathe him. Next, remember that in nature, dogs don't wash themselves. They go in the water or roll in the mud in order to cool off when it's hot. That's a natural instinct. Use that instinct to your advantage and give your dog a good workout, a brisk walk, a run, a treadmill or rollerblade session before the bath. Get him good and hot. This is easier in summer. Make the water lukewarm and appealing. You can also associate bath time with treats, but don't rely on them. A tired, relaxed dog that's just worked up a sweat is your best bet for a happy bath. Don't allow possessiveness over toys and food. Make sure your dog knows that his toys are your toys first. Make sure he is calm submissive or active submissive before you feed him, and that he doesn't growl if you come near him when feeding. Don't allow out-of-control barking. If your dog has an excessive barking problem, most of the time it will be due to physical and psychological frustration. This is a dog desperate for more physical activities and a more proactive pack leader. Your dog is trying to tell you something with his bark. Listen to him. Dogs and kids. The subject of dogs and children could be a book unto itself. As someone who grew up around animals and is raising his own kids among a pack of dogs, I can attest to the fact that living with dogs can be one of the most rewarding and memorable experiences of a child's life. Dogs teach children empathy. They teach them responsibility and caretaking. They teach them to be in tune with Mother Nature. They teach them balance. They teach them unconditional love. I wouldn't dream of raising Andre and Calvin without the joy of having dogs in their lives. However, we must always remember that when we keep a dog, we are inviting a carnivorous predator to live with us in our home. As close as we are to dogs, human and dog are separate species. It is our responsibility as parents and pet owners to protect our most precious family members, our children, and to make sure both our kids and our dogs know how to coexist safely and happily. More than half of serious dog bites and fatalities in the United States happen to children from 5 to 9 years of age. But babies are especially vulnerable. As I write this, Southern California is still reeling over the tragic death of a Glendale newborn, snatched from her mother's arms by the grandparents' Rottweiler. Invariably, in such cases, the owners are in denial. "He was always such a gentle dog," they say. Then, usually a neighbor comes forward and indicates that there may have been warning signs that were missed or ignored. A baby can be confusing for any dog who has never seen one before. Babies smell different from adult humans. They are shaped differently from adult humans. They sound and move differently from adult humans. For dogs with strong prey instincts, just the tiny size and weakness of a baby may trigger an attack. In addition, the family will naturally be fawning over the baby and not paying as much attention to the dog. If your dog has a problem with dominance or is obsessive over you, you may be heading for trouble. Families who are expecting a baby and have a dog in the house must first sit down and honestly evaluate the situation. What is their dog's temperament? What is the dog-owner relationship? If the parents are weak pack leaders and are letting a dominant dog run their household, especially if it is a powerful breed of dog that has shown aggression in the past, if the dog is used to constant attention and is territorial or possessive, I would seriously recommend the family find a new home for the dog long before the baby arrives. As important as dogs are in my life, I know that as a father I would never put my kids' lives in danger. There are some household situations where dogs and babies should not mix, though this is more often due to the owner's relationship with the dog than with the dog itself. If socialized properly, not only can most dogs live peacefully with babies, but they can also become their devoted protectors. But if there is even the slightest doubt in your mind about your ability to handle your dog in all situations, I suggest you take the 9 months you have to find your dog a suitable new home. This may be heartbreaking for you, but the good news is dogs do move on much faster than humans. The dog will feel disoriented at first when he moves to a new pack, but in nature, wolves do change packs when the need arises. If a pack gets too big for the resources in the environment, wolves will split off and find or form new groups. If you find the right home for him, your dog will adjust after a day or two. It's his instinct to adjust and try to fit in. He'll recognize you if he sees or smells you again, but he won't spend his time pining for you. Remember, dogs live in the moment. Preparing dogs for the blessed event. Assuming you are not in the situation I describe in the previous paragraphs, there are many things you can do to prepare your dog for the baby's arrival, and most important, to condition him to respect the baby as another pack leader. You need to start early. Any potential weakness in your pack leader-pack follower bond should be corrected now. If your dog is overly dependent, anxious, or has separation anxiety issues, he may react strongly to a change in the pack structure. As difficult as it seems, you may need to desensitize your dog by beginning to act a bit cooler toward him long before the baby comes home. Don't let him nervously shadow you as you walk around the house. Stop allowing him to sleep with you. Set new rules about the furniture he is allowed to sit on. Let him know that the baby's room is off limits. Practice walking him with a stroller or carriage, always making sure he is behind the carriage. Encourage and reward calm submission during these sessions. Once the baby is born, bring home a blanket or piece of baby clothing with the baby's scent on it and introduce it to your dog. This is a way to have your dog meet your baby before they ever come face to face. Don't stick the item into your dog's nose and have him sniff. Set boundaries at first. Make him sniff from the other side of the room. Then instruct him to come slightly closer, but not any closer than you would allow him near the baby. This isn't an unnatural thing for you to request of your dog. Remember, in nature, the mother dog initially keeps her pups away from the others in the pack. The dog must always be calm, submissive around the baby's scent. Correct any anxious or fixated behavior. Reward only calm, submissive behavior. When the baby comes home, don't introduce your dog to her outside the house. Make sure the baby is in the house, and then invite the dog in afterward. Make it clear that it's the baby's house, not the dog's. Introduce your dog to the baby in stages. Start by letting him know the baby from across the room. Then, little by little, you can let him get closer. Your calm, assertive energy is vital. Once Illusion was comfortable with me bringing my sons around the pack, I would walk through the pack carrying them while projecting my most assertive form of calm, assertive energy. I held my sons with pride. I was communicating to the pack that these babies were a part of me the pack leader. They were to be respected in the same way the pack leader was respected. My boys then learned their behavior from me. They watched how I interacted with the dogs and imitated that way of being. At the same time as you are sensitizing dog to kid, you need to teach your child as she grows how to respect the dog while remaining a pack leader. That's why supervision is so important.